Today, I'm Grace Wan. Tonight, Oakland-based investigative reporter and Pulitzer finalist Shoshana Walter takes us inside the hidden world of America's rehab industry. Her new book, Rehab, An American Scandal, reveals how programs meant to help people overcome addiction may exploit them instead. She shares what it will take to fix the system. Plus, San Francisco's Dance Mission Theater has weathered financial challenges that have shuttered other performance groups. And we'll hear from Christy Kiefer, the theater's executive director, on how it's still bringing communities together through movement and activism. But first, since Robert F. Kennedy Jr. took the reins at the Department of Health and Human Services, both the CDC and FDA have seen sweeping changes, moves that critics say have created uncertainty and disrupted longstanding practices. One immediate consequence for all of us? Confusion over who should get this year's updated COVID vaccine. With conflicting messages from the federal government, state officials, and medical professionals, many people aren't sure whether they or their children are eligible or if the shot is even recommended. Here to help us make sense of the current landscape is a State of the Bay favorite, UCSF infectious disease expert Dr. Monica Gandhi. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Gandhi. While we're waiting for Dr. Gandhi to get back on, State of the Bay listeners, we're opening the phones up right now, early tonight, from you.
Hi, thank you. Sorry about that.
Oh, yeah, no worries. We're asking our listeners to share what questions they have about the new COVID vaccine guidelines, and they can join by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Dr. Gandhi, so as everyone knows, RFK Jr. has taken over the Department of Health and Human Services. How has his tenure thus far shifted what we're seeing at a national level in terms of vaccine oversight?
So, you know, RFK Jr., before he started as HHS secretary, there was a real concern that he was someone who didn't seem to understand that vaccines are life-saving, that they decrease mortality. They've been one of the most significant advances. He was part of a board of something called the Children's Defense Fund, which really, if you look at it, which he had to leave to be confirmed, is really linking vaccines to disorders that there's no indication that there's vaccine links to autism, for example. So big concern, even getting him confirmed to Senator Bill Cassidy from Tennessee, who's a physician, cast the deciding vote, and he made him promise at his confirmation hearing that he would not question the efficacy of vaccines because they have been well established as really important, especially childhood vaccines. And what we've seen since he started is a lot of chaos, a lot of doubt sown about vaccines, including, importantly, very summarily firing in June the committee that provides advice to the CDC on which vaccine should be on the vaccine schedule every fall.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, my understanding is that that RFK Jr. has appointed a new slate of advisors for that committee, and they're meeting this week. What do we know about that new group?
So there's 8 new members, and he's considering 7 more. And not all 8 of them are against vaccination, actually, but one particularly, Dr. Robert Maloney, kind of made it a point to question not only just the safety of the COVID vaccine and the efficacy, but said he invented it, which is inaccurate, and also importantly said it was mass killing people and did that throughout the pandemic. I will say as a side note, he asked me to debate him at some point in the pandemic, and I didn't think that was the right thing to do because the data is not on his side, including, by the way, data from quoted by the NIH director, Jay Bhattacharya, in a recent Washington Post piece. He quoted a recent JAMA paper that I wrote a commentary for by John Ioannidis at Stanford that showed that this vaccine saved millions of lives during the COVID pandemic. So the data isn't, you know, on his side. And I think he's the most sort of obvious person who would be raising the question of, quote, mass killing, end quote, from these vaccines. And so we all saw, or not all of us, but many of us watched very wrapped up, I don't know, with rapt attention, RFK Jr.'s hearing not last Thursday, but Thursday before in front of the Senate Finance Committee, where he really repeated some of those concerns that the vaccine wasn't safe and that it did not save lives. So right now, those, like you said, Thursday and Friday, the new ACIP that was appointed, handpicked by RFK Jr. is going to meet, and we'll have a better idea after that. Because right now, if you look at the CDC webpage, it's kind of confusing. And so is all the fact that all the other organizations say something different.
Well, it is confusing, which is why I'm glad that we have you here. So let's just get down to the nitty gritty. So for this year's COVID vaccine, has the vaccine been updated? And what is in this vaccine that's new for this year? What is it trying to address?
Yes. So it has been updated. It's called the 2025-2026 COVID vaccine. There are two, as they've always been, from mRNA vaccines, one from Moderna, one from Pfizer, and then there's one from Novavax. And Novavax is more of a protein adjuvant-based vaccine, and both Pfizer and Moderna are the mRNA vaccines. And they have been updated, and they are more or less available, but we'll definitely talk about that.
Yeah. And who should be getting this updated shot this fall?
So to be fair, actually, and I wrote a piece about this in MedPage, the ACIP, the old ACIP, the one that had really good qualifications, were weighing, even prior to the start of this administration, going to a more risk-based approach for COVID vaccines. 65 years and older, those who are younger, anyone who have comorbidities, pregnant women, because pregnant women are by definition actually immunocompromised. So to be honest, every pregnant woman is immunocompromised, and also 6 months to 2 year olds. So the ACIP was already weighing the one before this was always weighing that we would do a risk-based approach. The reason they probably didn't for boosters before this is we have such a fractured healthcare system. The way it works is insurers will only pay if the CDC says that you need a booster. So they kind of said up till now, boosters for everyone. But to be fair, those groups that I just said are what the groups that the WHO recommends, the World Health Organization, and most countries around the world. These are the groups that are most at risk for severe COVID and who really need the COVID vaccine.
So much conversation has happened since COVID began about long COVID, and people who have long COVID don't necessarily have had severe COVID, or is it just any case of COVID may or may not result in long COVID?
So the best data really does seem like severe COVID is what leads to longer symptoms, which kind of makes sense because it's a process of inflammation. Now, there absolutely are some people who have long COVID symptoms without having that severe disease, but the best data sets, and I would say, published in the kind of highest level journals like Nature, really do look like it's associated with severity of disease, which is why having severe COVID is not only impossible, it should not even be conceivable at this point, because we've had the vaccine since January 2021, and anyone who's at risk for severe COVID should absolutely be getting the vaccine every fall, winter.
So what if you don't, you aren't in that category of that group that you just described, other older than 65, 0 to 24 months, pregnant, or suffering from another disease that makes you more prone? What if you just want to get the COVID vaccine but don't meet that criteria? Is that going to be okay? And would that be covered by insurance? Do we know?
Well, that's a very good question, because now we get into the fracturing of what's happening. So the CDC website right now says that, of course, ACIP will meet and we'll see if there's new recommendations. But right now it says in that group, if you're perfectly healthy and you're 32 years old, it's a conversation between doctor and patient. It's called shared decision making. And by saying that, that could open the door for insurers not to cover that vaccine and have that choice for a healthy 30-year-old. Now, you all know that the West Coast, and specifically what I mean by that is Oregon, Washington, and California, have formed a West Coast Health Alliance, which are being more like our old vaccine recommendations, kind of if you want it, you can get it. And insurers in these states may end up saying, fine, you can get it, because the West Coast Health Alliance says that. The American Academy of Pediatrics says everyone 6 months to 24 months should get it. The CDC doesn't put them in a special category, which they should be, because they're very young. They haven't been exposed to COVID, and they also have immature immune systems. So it's the right thing, what the American Academy of Pediatrics says. But if you're sitting in, say, Ohio, you don't have the West Coast Health Alliance, and the CDC says a 12-month-old can't get it, the insurance may not necessarily have to pay for it, given what's happening with the CDC guidance. In this state, I went on three websites today, CVS, Walgreens, and I also looked at Kaiser, and you can kind of get it. But I have to tell you that it actually asks you if you have a comorbidity. And you don't have to swear that you say yes, but it indicates it's sort of trying to screen you. And you can just say, I understand this is for people with comorbidities, and move on. Some of the comorbidities, by the way, are very lax, in the sense that CDC has a list that includes ever smoked, physically inactive. So I'm going to do that one. Yeah. And or like overweight, for example, things that are pretty common. So you can skirt around it. But that's likely, we are just more liberal here in California with that West Coast Health Alliance and our recommendations. Mm-hmm. I think it could be hard in some areas of the country. And that hearing that was held with RFK Jr. had Bill Cassidy say, you know, I have a CEO of a company, his wife has lung cancer, she's not 65 years old, and she couldn't get the COVID vaccine. Ooh. And I want you to address that.
Wow. Well, we have a question from a listener who writes, with RFK Jr. at the helm and cuts to public health programming staff and funds, are we at risk of getting less safe vaccines? Like, who's regulating vaccine safety?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. That's a really interesting question, because the reasoning that RFK Jr. is using is saying that these vaccines, to pull back from vaccines. I mean, he couldn't even say in that hearing that he truly believes in the measles vaccine, even though we've had the highest number of measles this year than we've had in 30 years. But when he says that, his ostensible reason is actually around vaccine safety. Now, I really just want to say as loud and clear as possible that there's no link to vaccines to autism. There was a study that was just absolutely a bad study that got published a long time ago in The Lancet. It got pulled. It was wrong. It's been debunked over and over again. And the Children's Defense Fund and RFK Jr. links to, you know, a study that doesn't exist anymore and was absolutely wrong. And so vaccines, it's been looked at again and again, are not linked to autism. I think autism's very complicated and multifactorial, and also we diagnose it more, but it's not vaccine related. So his ostensible reason is safety. And so do I think the FDA is going to let less safe vaccines out there? No. I think what's going to happen is the opposite, that people are going to get distrust in vaccines. If the HHS secretary, when a vaccine has been very, very well tested, including adverse effects, including safety, including the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine have been massively tested, if he says they're not safe, people, because he has a position of power, may hear that, and then what we're going to be less safe from are actually infectious diseases.
Well, last question before we have to let you go. Given what's happening at the CDC and kind of with the Trump administration agencies, where do you recommend that listeners go to get the most up-to-date and accurate information on COVID and other vaccine recommendations?
You know, I would go to the Infectious Disease Society of America. I, as an infectious disease doctor, I'm in that society. Actually, the majority, I don't know a single ID doctor that's not in that society. It's starting to make its own recommendations for vaccines. And if you are a parent of a child, go to the American Academy of Pediatrics for Children, and then IDSA.
Yeah, so we heard IDSA and then the American Academy of Pediatrics. Well, thank you, Monica, for joining us. That was Monica Gandhi, infectious disease expert at UCSF. Coming up next after this short break, we'll hear about America's fraught addiction treatment industry from investigative reporter Shoshana Walter, author of the new book, Rehab, an American Scandal. Stay with us.
Mm-hmm. This week on Bay Made, conversations recorded live at KALW's event space in downtown San Francisco as part of our series, The Bay Agenda. We'll take a look at threats to federal public lands, media journalism at San Quentin, Recology's Artist in Residence program, and art from the 111 Mina Gallery. So tune in all week at 11:30 a.m. to Bay Made, right here on 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
I'm Lynn Winter Gross.
And I'm Miriam Goodman. We are the hosts of Not Born Yesterday, KALW's first podcast in residence. Our show explores the joys and challenges of aging with experts in the field.
And in our next episode, we're looking at ageism in the workplace and why are some people unretiring?
Join us Monday at 7 p.m. for Not Born Yesterday.
Right here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. America has poured billions of dollars into fighting the opioid epidemic, yet overdose deaths continue, and many of the programs meant to save lives are plagued by exploitation, punishment, and false promises. In her new book, Rehab, An American Scandal, Oakland-based investigative reporter Shoshana Walter exposes how the rehab industry often fails the very people it claims to help, while at the same time profiting from their pain and sometimes even their deaths. Rehab documents the stories of four Americans navigating different aspects of the addiction crisis. It illustrates how race, class, stigma, and systemic neglect shape who gets a chance at recovery and who doesn't. And tonight, Shoshana Walter is here with us. She's a Pulitzer Prize finalist and award-winning reporter for the Marshall Project, and her book is just a definite read. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Shoshana.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And State of the Bay listeners, we want to hear your stories and questions. Have you or a loved one ever gotten treatment for addiction? And what was that experience like? You can join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@klw.org or find us on social media at Blue Sky, Instagram, and more. So, Shoshana, you open Rehab by asking how 21-year-old Donovan Doyle, he's a young man from a caring family, just disappears from a mountain rehab in Southern California. His parents researched the rehab. They got assurances that this was a great program, but it turned out to be a death sentence for their son. When did you realize that this wasn't just a terrible one-off, but rather a glimpse into a larger and more problematic system?
Oh, gosh. Well, I first started looking at addiction treatment as a topic to report on about 8 years ago when I was a reporter at Reveal. And I'm a longtime criminal justice reporter. I've done stories related to drug use and drug policy. And at this time, I just kind of stumbled across this treatment program that courts across Oklahoma and Arkansas were using in lieu of incarceration. So these were people who were getting sent to rehab to get treatment. But what I discovered about this program is that it had been founded by a former poultry industry executive, and the rehab was sending people to work unpaid at chicken processing plants where they were making chicken products for KFC and Popeyes and Walmart and Rachel Ray Nutrish pet food brand. It just really caught me totally by surprise. I had never heard of anything like this before. It made me wonder, you know, in this day and age when so many policymakers and lawmakers have come together around this notion of addiction as a disease deserving of treatment, you know, why would uncompensated labor be considered a form of treatment? Mm. And it made me want to understand how common that is and what does the rest of our treatment landscape look like? And is it serving people the way that it should be? And that's, you know, that set me down this path where I discovered, you know, the system is not really working the way it should be if we want to get more people out of addiction.
I mean, uncompensated labor is just a way of saying slave labor, it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, these individuals, most of them were court ordered there, which meant that they really had no choice about being there. Mm. And they often worked long hours, in really, really difficult, dangerous jobs. And so, yeah, I mean, it definitely, they were captive to their situation, for sure.
Well, your book focuses on the stories of four different people, April, Chris, Wendy, and then a doctor, Dr. Larry Lay. And it illustrates different aspects of the rehabilitation industry. And after reading it, my takeaway was it is so complicated to navigate this industry, which is a billion-dollar industry that has really profited from the opioid epidemic. So tell us a little bit about, I mean, you talked about one kind of model where uncompensated labor is considered a form of treatment. I mean, if you were to open the Pandora's box, what kinds of treatment would you see within this industry?
Absolutely. So you have this uncompensated labor type program that we were just talking about. When you opened the segment, you talked about this this young man, Donovan Doyle, who went to this rehab in Southern California and he ended up dying. And Donovan is someone who attended a insurance-funded program that is pretty representative of the type of programs that proliferated with the expansion of the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, there are outpatient programs, relatively short-term residential programs that typically last no longer than a month or two. And then there's another kind of bucket of treatment, which would be particularly when you're talking about opioid addiction, would be medication-assisted treatment like Suboxone, buprenorphine, methadone, that can only be accessed through certain providers. I would say by and large, these are kind of the three major forms of treatment when it comes to opioid addiction. But there are lots of other forms of treatment and many, many barriers to treatment. So despite the fact that the Affordable Care Act expanded access to treatment to millions of Americans, it still remains very difficult for people to access certain forms of treatment. There are a lot of barriers.
Well, let's take the story of April. She is a young mother in the Philadelphia area. She's experienced both drug addiction as well as sexual abuse. She has small children. And even at her lowest, when she decides, I really need to get some help, she has such a hard time finding the kind of help that she needs.
Yeah, absolutely. April is a mother of three. She herself grew up with a mother who was addicted to crack cocaine, and she grew up in a Black community in South Philly and really bore witness to how our policies during that era played out. During that time, addiction, particularly crack addiction, was viewed as a moral failing, mm-hmm. was viewed as something that needed to be punished. And so drug users, particularly Black and brown drug users, were incarcerated en masse and heavily policed. You know, fast forward to the opioid epidemic, we've developed a very different approach. We expanded access to treatment, and people generally seem to agree that addiction now is a disease that's worthy of some compassion and worthy of medical care. But I think what April's experience shows is that there are certain people who still don't have the benefit of that cultural shift. Mm-hmm. April is a Black mom who grew up in poverty. And when she herself was struggling with addiction, she was the sole caregiver of her children, and she found that there was really no place for her to go. And mothers are, especially mothers living in poverty, low-income mothers who are the sole caregivers, are the worst off when it comes to being able to access treatment in the United States. You know, over the course of the opioid epidemic, millions more Americans have access to treatment, but that benefit has not arrived for mothers. In fact, what I found in my reporting is that the number of treatment programs that cater to mothers have declined drastically over the years of the opioid epidemic. And we know from studies that studies after studies have shown that treatment programs that allow mothers to remain with their children have better outcomes for the entire family. So right now we're seeing overdose numbers, overdose deaths decline, start to tick down and decline nationally. For mothers over the past few years, we've seen those overdose death rates start to skyrocket. And for April, what resulted from all this is that there was no treatment program for her to go to, and so her children were taken from her. And that's a very typical experience for women struggling with addiction, particularly mothers.
You know, and you wonder, I mean, just reading her story, how she could concentrate on her own recovery when she was worried about her children and who whether they were going to be taken away, which, as you point out, is what happened, and what their futures would be like. I mean, and that's in contrast to the story of Chris, who is a white young man living in the South. And, you know, you point out that, you know, the benefit of the ACA was that it extended monies, insurance monies, to the rehab industry. So there's more places for people to go, but not necessarily good places. And those places that advertised their capabilities, they often, as you point out, they show white patients, and it's like, Chris isn't a terrible person. He has not morally failed. He just has a disease.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think that some of these benefits that we've seen, the expansion of our treatment system, has really disproportionately benefited white communities. And there are still enormous gaps and racial disparities in who has access to treatment, who even can finish treatment, and what happens after treatment.
Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area, and I'm your host, Grace Wan. We're talking about how rehab really works in America with journalist Shoshana Walter, author of Rehab, an American Scandal. We'd love to hear from you. Have you or a loved one experienced trying to get into rehab or getting some kind of treatment for yourself, whether inpatient or outpatient? And what questions do you have about finding safe, effective addiction care here in the Bay Area? You can call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Email us at stateofthebay@klw.org or find us on social media, Blue Sky, Instagram, and more. So we were talking about Chris, one of the men, one of the individuals that you profile on your book. We were saying that, you know, Chris gets access to rehab, but the rehab that he gets access to, this is the judge basically says, you go to this rehab or you go to prison. And the rehab is called Senecor, and it pretty much sounds worse than prison. Shoshana, tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so the Senecor Foundation was actually the subject of a podcast series I did with my former colleagues at Reveal called American Rehab. So if that's of interest to anyone listening, definitely look that up.
It's a good one.
But that's initially. Thank you.
It is good.
But that's initially how I met Chris, reporting on that podcast series. And what I learned about Chris is that, you know, he started out experimenting with drugs as a teenager, and that developed into an addiction in his early 20s, and he ended up getting arrested and given the chance to go to treatment instead of prison. And what he was told about the Senecor Foundation was that he'd get to live and work there for 2 years. He'd get to save up money for after he left rehab. He'd get counseling. He'd get medical care. But when he arrived, he quickly discovered that the most of his time, up to 80 hours per week, would be spent working in really hard manual labor jobs, you know, building scaffolding at chemical plants, laying asphalt in the broiling Louisiana heat, or cleaning up after LSU football games. He rarely had time for counseling. You know, I spoke with his counselor when he was there, and she would try to stick her head into his bedroom to see how he was doing. She'd say, "How are you?" He'd say, "Fine." And then she'd mark that as a counseling session. And you know, that was essentially his, you know, sole form of treatment in this program. He got badly injured and he relapsed on multiple occasions because actually these manual labor jobs, it's very easy to find substances in these jobs. And it really had the effect of making him feel trapped and hopeless and powerless.
Honestly, I mean, you describe in the book how Senecor has this, for the first 2 or 3 months that he was there, he was learning the Senecor way. And one of them was to sit in a chair with his arms and knees at a 90 degree angle and kind of go through like a struggle session where, you know, he had to sit there silently and take abuse or and whatnot. And he could do, and you could rat on other people. I mean, it sounds horrible. I don't know what is therapeutic about any of that.
Yeah, I mean, these practices are actually far more common in rehab than you might think. There's what you're describing, where they sit in a chair and they can't make eye contact with anyone. They have to remain completely silent in this erect posture. There are the regular circles that they all participate in called the game, where they each take turns holding one another accountable, which can literally look like screaming at a person in the middle of the circle, calling them all sorts of names, which, as you can imagine, can be incredibly traumatic for people, especially with histories of trauma. And all of these practices stem from this recovery community founded in 1958 called Synanon, which has its own kind of fascinating history. It was founded by a former oil salesman who had struggled with alcoholism and hated AA. I mean, he felt like in AA, people could get away with anything. They could relapse and lie about their sobriety and no one would ever know. And he wanted to create a community where everyone could hold each other accountable and call each other out. And so he founded this group called Synanon, which kind of became like the precursor to rehab in the United States. And it ended up growing into this massive multi-million dollar operation that supported itself in part by putting participants to work. And over time, it morphed into something like a cult. I mean, the founder enriched himself, started ordering people to have vasectomies, arranged marriages, no sugar. Everyone was required to shave their heads. They had a mercenary army that attempted to assassinate a local civil rights attorney with a rattlesnake. It really went off the rails, and to say the least.
Yes.
And, you know, just the history of that program just kind of shows how easily this population can be exploited for somebody else's gain. And still to this day, there are programs operating in the country that borrow their tactics and practices from Synanon.
You know, there's this punitive aspect that you're describing about rehab, as if someone who, even in the ones that are sort of directed towards middle class people, as if there's just sheer lack of will, you know, and they just need to be punished. And that's going to be enough to get them to stop taking drugs, which we medically recognize that this is a disease. So it's fascinating to me that this is still allowed to exist, you know, reading your book. And I guess I want to ask, are these centers regulated at all?
Every state regulates rehabs differently, you know, and California is one of the rehab capitals of the country. So our rehab system is humongous, and people travel from all over the United States to come here for treatment. But what I found again and again is that the oversight over treatment is really poor. I mean, regulators are overwhelmed by the sheer number of facilities. Today in California, there are more than 2,000 certified and licensed treatment facilities. Many of them are concentrated in Southern California, which is this kind of like rehab mecca. And yet there are only 5 investigators in all of Southern California wow. tasked with overseeing these programs and responding to complaints and performing inspections. And there are all sorts of loopholes to licensure. So in many states, if you're a faith-based program, you provide only 12-step programming and don't provide medical care, you're exempt from licensure. In California, outpatient facilities are still not required to be licensed, and sober living homes are also not subject to licensure. So even when a facility is, you know, subject to a complaint investigation, and the state goes as far as to revoke their license, it's very easy for treatment companies to just get around that oversight by operating an outpatient program and housing people in a sober living home. Mm-hmm. And that's often what's happening with these programs. So the oversight is just not as strict as you might imagine, and certainly not in comparison to other medical facilities and professions.
Well, that, I mean, kind of goes into a listener question here. This listener writes, what are the top red flags we should be looking for when vetting rehab programs? What are the essential components?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I will say a lot of this depends on the personal individual needs of the person who's looking for treatment, but you know, I would check to make sure that the facility is licensed. I would want to know, does the facility have the capacity to prescribe medications that a person might need, including psychiatric medications? Does the facility have trained staff who could treat both the person's addiction and their mental health conditions? And I would, you know, I would be skeptical of certain features of treatment that often seem to be mainstays, especially in Southern California. You know, I would ask, you know, how often do they test patients' urine? You know, daily urine testing or every other day is excessive and really not necessary for treatment purposes. And maybe an indication that rehab is overbilling insurance companies for treatment. Does the facility place extra emphasis on the amenities like horses or massages or these huge elaborate gyms? Those are the kinds of things I would be skeptical about when vetting a rehab facility.
I mean, it sounds like the celebrity rehab promises in Malibu that we heard so much about in the 2000s with all those mm-hmm. rehab shows. Well, I mean, one aspect of your book is the fact that there is medication out there that really helps blunt withdrawing from an addiction and actually helps manage an addiction. But that in the United States, in other countries like France, you can get this type of medication and supportive help. But in the United States, we seem to be reluctant to do that. Can you talk about what medication is available and why there is this sort of negative attitude towards it in the rehab community?
Absolutely. I mean, the two main forms of addiction treatment medications are methadone and buprenorphine. And, you know, prior to the beginning of the opioid epidemic, patients actually couldn't get buprenorphine for addiction treatment in this country. It was actually against the law for doctors to prescribe it to patients who needed it. You know, you mentioned France. At that time in France, the country was going through its own heroin epidemic. And the country's response was to make buprenorphine as widely available as possible through any doctor, through any pharmacy. And partially as a result of that policy shift, overdose deaths declined 79% over 4 years.
Wow.
In the United States, you know, we had an entirely different approach. We passed a law that limited the number of patients per provider to 30 patients. Doctors were required to apply for special permission to prescribe it. They had to take a special training and subject themselves to oversight from the Drug Enforcement Administration. And there is just this real, enduring, persistent belief in this country that providing a patient with a medication that will help them quell their cravings, that will prevent withdrawal symptoms, that that is not real recovery, that it is just replacing one drug for another. And the Drug Enforcement Administration at this time was especially suspicious of buprenorphine, which was later released as the medication Suboxone. And in my book, I tell the story of one of the earliest Suboxone prescribers in the country, Dr. Larry Lay, who, you know, his story is a little bit nuanced, but, you know, he basically found a way to prescribe Suboxone to more patients than were legally allowed under the law. And that drew the scrutiny of local law enforcement and the Drug Enforcement Administration, who began investigating him, sending in undercover agents to his offices. And after months and months of investigation, they actually raided his clinics, arrested him and all of his other employees, and shut his clinics down. And his patients, many of his patients relapsed. They couldn't find other prescribers. Some of them overdosed and died. And when Larry finally went to trial, he was acquitted and the charges against his other employees were all dropped. So when I met Larry, you know, his life had kind of been turned upside down by all of this. He lost his medical license. He relapsed with alcohol. And he just wanted someone to acknowledge that he had done a brave thing, which was prescribe this medication to people who needed it. And so I was able to get access to the entire criminal case file, you know, records that are typically completely confidential and off limits to journalists. I read through all the DEA records. I watched hundreds of hours of undercover agent footage. And so I was really able to see what they saw in their investigation and what these clinics were like and the impact that it had on these patients who were suddenly cut off from this medication that was helping them.
It is such an interesting story and both depressing but eye-opening. And we're going to have to leave it there for now. Shoshana Walter is a journalist and author of the new book, Rehab, An American Scandal. You can pick that up now at any independent bookstore near you. And I suggest it. It's a great read. Shoshana, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. I so appreciate it.
Coming after the break, we've got Chrissy Kiefer. She's the executive director of San Francisco's Dance Mission Theater. Stay with us.
Join KALW Wednesday at a live event celebrating the Golden State Valkyries and their fans. It's a live recording of Bounce, the Golden State Valkyries' first season in the Bay, at our studio event space. We're bringing together the Bounce reporters and Valks fans in conversation about what we've seen this season and what's to come. We're doing it with sponsored food from Joyride Pizza, an auction, and lots of giveaways. It's happening at 220 Montgomery Street in downtown San Francisco Wednesday at 7. Find more info at kalw.org/events.
I'm Lynn Winter Gross.
And I'm Miriam Goodman. We are the hosts of Not Born Yesterday, KALW's first podcast in residence. Our show explores the joys and challenges of aging with experts in the field.
And in our next episode, we're looking at ageism in the workplace and why are some people unretiring?
Join us Monday at 7 p.m. for Not Born Yesterday.
Right here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
I'm Fred Pitts, and this is State of the Bay. Recent federal funding cuts present unwelcome challenges, especially in the arts, where budgets can be slim and staffing can be light. So we at State of the Bay wanted to know how Bay Area arts organizations are surviving. And tonight, we've invited Chrissy Kiefer, Executive Director of Dance Mission Theater in San Francisco, to share with us some of the impacts of recent funding cuts and her strategies, both economic and artistic, to survive and even thrive. Chrissy Kiefer, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We are glad you're here. We should start out by asking you a little bit about the history of Dance Mission Theater and your role within it.
Sure. Actually, this year I'm celebrating my 50th anniversary as an art activist.
Oh, congratulations.
No, 50 years at this. I started a dance company with five other women in Eugene, Oregon, called the Wallflower Order Dance Collective. And we toured all over the United States and Europe and did many collaborations during that time. And then we moved from Eugene to Boston and then to Berkeley. And then we broke up. And I started with another woman, Nina Fichter, the Dance Brigade. And we did a ton of projects, including the Revolutionary Nutcracker Sweetie, which is a kind of famous in the Bay Area. We did that for 10 years in a collaboration with Mary Watkins, who did all the composing for that. Mm-hmm. We did the Tchaikovsky score. And then after that, I started a dance center called Brady Street Dance Center that eventually morphed into Dance Mission Theater at 24th and Mission. So this whole time, I've been running a dance company and running an art business. So it's a multifaceted organization, community extravaganza, trying to change the world one tendu, one pointed foot, one big jump, one drum at a time.
Any method to change the world is welcome.
Yes.
How long has Dance Mission Theater been at 24th and Mission?
Well, I've been running the business there, the scene there, since 1998. But before that, it was run by other people as Third Wave. And before that, it was something else. It's been a arts hub since the 70s, actually.
Wow.
So
wow.
It's been there a very long time, and it has legacy status at this point. So anybody who would take over after me would have to keep it a dance studio on the corner of 24th and Mission.
That's great.
Yeah.
Now, you've been active in advocating for the arts in the Bay Area, generally through your work with the Arts Task Force. How has the performing arts area changed in San Francisco since you've been a part of it?
Well, it's interesting. When I first started, there was not the same kind of money that there is now. We are all bemoaning the cuts because mm-hmm. the demands are so great financially. But when I first started, there was very little money around to actually do very much. There was the grants for the arts. There was money coming out of the San Francisco Arts Commission. And then when they made the cultural equity program, more money became available. And that was like in the early 90s.
Huh.
And then California Arts Council was completely cut by John Burton. So we went through that suffering. Mm-hmm. And then actually the last 15 years, there's been kind of multiple streams of income from multiple sources. But at the same time, the demands about how to run your organization have become gargantuan, anywhere from having to put everybody on payroll to soaring rents, mm-hmm. having to pay people minimum wages that actually are fair, but add to a tremendous burden for anybody trying to organize the situation. And then the culture in the community mm-hmm. has changed a lot as to what they're interested in. So there's really never a great time for the arts because arts have been kind of beleaguered in the United States. There's a real hostility towards art
mm-hmm.
that we've actually seen now, especially through the Trump administration, by his kind of, you know, slash and burn approaches. Mm-hmm. But, you know, John Burton did the same thing. He cut the California Arts Council. So we're looking at this thing of like, oh, we love artists and aren't artists great and artists are going to save us. And then, yeah, but we're not going to give you any money to do. You know, you're an outsider. You will always be an outsider. Get used to it.
And that's kind of how it's been with arts for what, 500-600 years? Even in Europe with Shakespeare was trying to find funding for artists through patrons. Now, how are federal funding cuts looking like they might be impacting the Dance Mission Theater and your efforts? Is there a large percentage of money you get from the federal government?
We got a very healthy grant in the last round, which was rescinded like everybody else's, due public performances at the BART station and in the neighborhood in order to kind of get in there and open up and massage an area that had become increasingly problematic in terms of drug use. So we got the Our Town grant from NEA, but that's gone now. And okay, yeah. We didn't expect to get that again, but we have many colleagues who are in deep despair and problematic programming because their grants were rescinded. And we operate in a community. So what happens to one happens to all. That's how we look at it. Nobody's an island in this community.
How do you imagine Dance Mission Theater is going to weather the cuts? I know you've had problems back in the 80s. Is there a new wisdom or thought process on how to survive the hard times in general?
Before COVID, we were 70% earned income and 30% contributed, which means our classes were full, our programming was full, our ticket sales were great. Mm-hmm. We had robust adult and youth program, and that culture has shifted. People don't want to come out as much as they used to. It was a real demonization of don't go to public events because you'll get COVID.
Exactly.
My age group is less likely to want to get in a theater with other people.
Right.
It's harder to drive and park. Transportation is expensive. Everything adds on to a ticket price.
Yeah, because I'm also an actor and I know very well the drop in patronage that's come after COVID, just trying to get people to come. And most theater companies survived on subscriptions, which were paid for by people in our age group. And so the motivation nowadays is trying to get younger people in to support the arts across the board. Can you talk about how Dance Mission Theater is responding artistically to this historic moment we're in?
Mm-hmm. Well, we always respond. That's what we do.
That's why I'm asking the question. I know very well what you all do.
So we have our own programs that we create that comes out of the vision of the Central Committee of Dance Mission. And then we also are a rental space for other organizations. We like to see ourselves as a hub for art and art activism and social justice. We like to see that effort being explored in our space. So that's the number one thing. And that's a kind of a value that we hold along the way of the last 50 years. We have our own programming, like we have a Dirt Festival coming up, Dance in Revolting Times, which is the theme.
I love the title, by the way.
Yes. The theme is Come Hell or High Water. Well, we're here because hell is here and climate change is everywhere. So that will happen in October. And then I have a show that is called Match Girl, which explored the homelessness and fentanyl crisis that was happening in San Francisco through COVID. I was involved in helping set up some murals in the Tenderloin for a year and a half during COVID when nobody wanted to go anywhere. And not only did we have this COVID problem, we had this enormous fentanyl poverty crisis, intersection, homeless crisis happening that was not being dealt with. So I took the story of the Match Girl, which was about poverty and wealth, and transformed it into a show about addiction and that 2008 financial crisis.
I love that. I've got one final question for you. If you could meet someone that you could either dance with or see a dance performance or talk with a dance performer from any time, who would it be and why?
A dancer?
Let's go specifically with a dancer or someone associated with dance performance.
I'd love to chat with.
Or dance with.
Oh, dance with. Well, I don't dance anymore, so that would just be a problem for everybody.
It might be a problem for the person as well if they're a dead person.
This is so awkward. I used to always want to dance with Brezhnikov.
I would too, and I'm not a dancer. Well, we are just about out of time tonight, but I've really enjoyed this conversation. If you'd like to find out more information about Dance Mission Theater, or more importantly, donate to Dance Mission Theater, check out their website, Dance Mission Theater, one word, .org. You can find their address. You can also see their upcoming programs as well. Chrissy Kiefer, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us tonight on State of the Bay.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure as well.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We want to thank all our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. Next Monday at 6, we'll hear about The Day the Sky Turned Orange. It's a new R&B and hip-hop musical inspired by that September 2020 day when the sky turned orange. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. If you have any questions about what you heard, email us at any time at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Heather Hughes. The last segment was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and D Minor was our board operator. Coming up next is Not Born Yesterday, the show about the joys and challenges of aging and its exploration of the issues and opportunities of getting older. They talk to experts in the field. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.